Good time period, fellow netizen. Welcome to Spider on the Web number 63, the podcast for those with an odd cast of thought. This time around, I propose to read to you David Gerald's new short story collection, The Involuntary Human, from cover to cover, I promise. But first, here are Spike Jones and his City Snickers, with a track that is mentioned and described in the novella Stardance by Spider and Gene Robinson, the Jones Laughing Record. I dedicate it to my granddaughter, Marisa. That's about a month worth of antidepressants right there. If you can listen to that track all the way through without cracking a smile, seek medical attention quickly. I have to tell you, that's exactly how I felt when I received the happy news this week from the extremely Tony Smith, owner-proprietor of Starship Sofa, one of the very finest SF-related podcasts in this or any other ficton, that I have won this year's Sofanaut Awards in both categories for which I was nominated, Best Flash Fiction for In the Olden Days, and Best Narrator as well. I mean, I had to laugh, and then I couldn't stop. The moment you finish this podcast, you should hasten over to StarshipSofa.com and navigate your way to Engine Room Number 12, the Sofanaut Awards, and listen to Tony and his principal unindicted co-conspirator, Mark Borman, say outrageously nice things about me.
Told you George had secret weapon.
Secret weapon? What was it, George?
Dumb luck.
It is quite clear from what Mark tells Tony, by the way, that you, the listeners to this podcast, were my dumb luck, the secret weapon that put me over the top for at least one of the Sofanauts. Colin and Jeannie asked you to take a moment to vote in their most recent mail-out, and you did. I thank you very kindly. Colin and Jeannie promised to use this power only for good. Now, here's a quick spot of actual music before we get down to the meat of this podcast, David Gerald's remarkable story collection, The Involuntary Human. This is a little bit of poetry and a little bit of music from the late, great Vladimir Vysotsky, unquestionably the most remarkable figure in the history of Russian music. It's excerpted from the soundtrack of one of three video documentaries about Vysotsky that have just begun to circulate on the BitTorrent world. I wish I could tell you the name of the song.
Когда на смерть идут, поют, а перед этим можно плакать, ведь самый страшный час в бою, час ожидания атаки. Снег минами изрыт вокруг, и почернел от пыли минной разрыв, и умирает друг, и значит смерть проходит мимо. Сейчас настанет мой черед, за мной одним идет охота. Будь проклят, 41-й год, ты вмерзшая в снега пехота. Мне кажется, что я магнит, что я притягиваю мины. Разрыв, и лейтенант хрипит, и смерть опять проходит мимо. А мы уже не в силах ждать, и нас ведет через траншеи окоченевшая вражда. Дырявящие шеи. Бой был коротким, а потом глушили водку ледяную и выковыривал ножом из-под ногтей я кровь чужую.
Уходим под воду. В нейтральной воде мы можем погоду, плевать на погоду. А если накроют, локаторы взвоют о нашей беде. Спасите наши души, мы бредим от удушья. Спасите наши души, спешите к нам. Услышьте нас на суше, наш сос все глуше, глуше, и ужас режет души напополам, и рвутся орды, но наверх не сметь. Там слева по борту, там справа по борту, там прямо по ходу мешает проходу рогатая смерть. Спасите наши души, мы бредим от удушья. Спасите наши души, спешите к нам. Услышьте нас на суше, наш сос все глуше, глуше, и ужас режет души напополам. Но здесь мы на воле, ведь это наш мир. Свихнулись мы, что ли, всплывать в минном поле? А ну без истерик! Мы врежемся в берег, сказал командир. Спасите наши души, мы бредим от удушья. Спасите наши души, спешите к нам. Услышьте нас на суше, наш сос все глуше, глуше, и ужас режет души напополам. Всплывем на рассвете. Приказ есть приказ. А гибнуть в отсвете уж лучше при свете. Наш путь не отмечен. Нам нечем, но помните нас. Спасите наши души, мы бредим от удушья. Спасите наши души, спешите к нам. Услышьте нас, наш сос все глуше, глуше, и ужас режет души напополам. Вот вышли наверх мы, но выхода нет. Вот полный на версии, натянуты нервы. Конец всем печалям, концам и началам. Мы рвемся к причалам за место торпед. Спасите наши души, мы приедем от удушья. Спасите наши души, спешите к нам, услышьте нас на суше. Наш сос все глуше, глуше, и ужас режет души напополам. Спасите наши души, спасите наши души.
All right, what I meant when I said I'd read you the entire short story collection, The Involuntary Human, was I will begin the reading portion of this podcast with the opening words of the book, my introduction to it, and I will close it with the last story in the book, 13 O'Clock. We begin. The Truth About David Gerald by Spider Robinson. For decades now, David and I have had a tradition of writing gag intros for one another for convention program books or collections like this one, typically consisting of the kinds of jokes one hears told at a roast, made even more virulent by a high pun content, and avoiding as far as possible any slightest taint of truth. But after all these years, it has finally dawned on me that comedy is hard work, and that it is amazing how much mature wisdom resembles being too tired. So for lack of anything else to do, I guess I'll just tell you the truth for once. David Gerald is one of the reasons I do what I do, why I started in the first place, and why I keep on doing it now that I know better. Because he constantly reminds me why I'm doing it. Every time I start to feel I'm wasting my time annoying a keyboard and am tempted to reconsider a life of crime, he and a bare handful of others keep reminding me what a holy chore, an amazing privilege, and a stone gas it is to be a science fiction writer. That's why one of the most important characters in Variable Star by Robert A. Heinlein and Spider Robinson is named Solomon Short. Like Crosby, Stills, Nash, and Young, David is a 60s survivor entering his 60s who has not just survived but flourished, kept getting higher, kept evolving, kept growing. I'm about the same age he is, and I wish I could say the same. He still believes, still walks the walk, still claps for Tink with more grace and style than ever. He's still getting better with each story, each book. He's been having one hell of a lot of fun since day one, and he ain't done yet. Evidence indicates he's just getting started. Like most of the world, I noticed David Gerald right away. Mr. Scott's final pun at the end of the Star Trek episode, The Trouble with Tribbles, David's very first sale, made me shout with pleasure. And there were some even more breathtaking puns in his first novel, The Flying Sorcerers. How many were his and how many can be blamed on co-author Larry Niven? Quick story. In Larry's own solo novel, Ringworld Engineers, the villain is a puppeteer named The Hindmost. I spent the whole book waiting for some character to exclaim, "The devil take the hindmost!" And when it failed to happen, I wrote Larry congratulating him on his enormous restraint. He wrote back, "Spider, it never occurred to me." I figured if David could get away with puns as unconscionable as the protagonist's name in The Flying Sorcerers, there was room in the business for someone like me. But it was equally clear right from the start that he was far more than just a funny man. The Tribble script was not a shaggy alien story. Its humor arose not from situation, but from its characters, and the author's fondness for them was almost palpable. The same with Flying Sorcerers. It wasn't just funnier than a typical Niven novel. It was more empathic, more compassionate toward its clueless characters, human and alien alike. And please don't take this as any kind of a knock on Larry. He has unique strengths of his own that nobody in the business, past or present, can match, deserves his dozens of Hugos and Nebulas, and is one of my all-time favorite authors. I missed The Space Skimmer because I was living in a shack on the shore of the Bay of Fundy at the time, way too busy nursing the garden, turning tall trees into firewood, and chopping through a foot of ice for water for morning coffee to get a whole lot of reading done by kerosene lamplight. But I had surfaced again by 1977, and Moonstar Odyssey hit me like a bolt of lightning. I'd known this Gerald guy was good, sure, but I'd had no idea he was Sturgeon good, Pangborn good, one of those whose characters become instant old friends. I was Galaxy's resident book reviewer by then, and I gave that book one of the strongest raves I ever printed. But that just didn't feel like enough. I sent him a letter, whose exact content is long gone from my leaky memory, but the gist of it must have been something like, "I am one of you. You are one of me. Glad you're there, brother." And he wrote back something along the lines of, "I know, we're going to be good friends for a long time." And so it has come to pass. 30 years later, we are still good friends, despite the puns, and an irritating tendency to write trilogies of at least 5 volumes, and to still win Hugos and Nebulas, and get big movie sales, and drive the coolest car in North America, and tell better dialect jokes than I do. Come to think of it, the hell with the bastard. Let him write his own for slugging her intro. I'm out of here. All right, one Gerald pun first. One. By great good fortune, the very first time I ever entered Disneyland, my guides were the two people who loved that place more than anyone since Walt died, Herb Varley and David Gerald. It was a totally pleasant day, one of the happiest in my well-stocked memory. Until we boarded the jungle boat ride at Adventureland, and David started to get steamed. It's hard not to enjoy robot hippos squirting water at you and audio-animatronic cannibals menacing you with spears, but the boat's captain kept up a running barrage of attempted humor over loudspeakers throughout the voyage. His jokes were abominable, but what really drove David crazy was the grossly substandard quality of the man's puns. They dishonored the art form. To his credit, David managed to grit his teeth and remain silent for the entire trip. But as we all prepared to disembark, he leaned over and murmured to me and Herb, "Now, Luke, you will get to see the dark side of the farce." Disneyland didn't even throw us out, once Herb and I explained why we had pushed him into the water. David actually offers a rebuttal to that anecdote. As far as I know, the first time an author has ever rebutted his short story collection's introduction. But if you want to read that, you'll have to buy a copy of the book. From www.nesfa.org. That's NESFA.org. Now to lead us gracefully into David's fiction, here is The Great Watermelon Slim with Smokestack Lightning.
Shining just like gold. Can you hear me calling you? Ooh. Tell me, baby, where did you stay last night? Yes, your hair's all tangled, dress don't fit you right. Can you hear me crying? Ooh. Tell me, baby, what's wrong with you? You don't love me like you used to do. Can you hear me screaming? Thank you. Who's been here now since I've been gone? A little bitty boy, derby on. How do I know, baby? He left his hat right here on my bureau. My hat ought to be. Can you hear me moaning? Ooh. Yeah, stop your train. Let a football ride. Stop your train. Let me come inside. Just like gold. Lord, I'm getting old. My hair is turning gray. I'd have bet my bottom dollar you did not treat me this way. Can you hear me? Thank you very much.
Before we proceed, be advised, this story comes with a quadruple X warning with a special homophobia advisory. It contains explicit scenes and language. Viewer discretion will be impossible, and you definitely do not want to be playing this on speakers in the presence of young or small minds. 13 O'Clock by David Gerald. 13 o'clock on a thirsty night, dry and windy after midnight. All the boys are paired up, disappeared into the desert, coupling darkly on the sand, have another beer. There's no place to go except ride the hog, and the hot air roars into your eyes at 70 miles per hour. Getting too old for this shit. Fucking boring. Bored with fucking. Bored with chasing fucking. Bored with waking up alone. And even more bored waking up with anyone else. And even beer can't cure that. Fuck me. Except that's the problem. No one wants to fuck me anymore. Too many years. Too many beers. And that other thing, that scar that starts right above my right eye and crawled down the corner of my mouth, pulling it into a permanent scowl. Some of my face looks like something from a slasher movie. Only the scar didn't happen when I was on the bike, but when I got off it at high speed, using the right side of my head as a brake shoe, which wasn't as much fun as it sounds, and not even with three beers. So I gave up on the queer bar for the night. The thing about queer bars, straight men think you just walk in and get a blowjob. Everybody's so fucking thirsty for cock, all you have to do is stand there, unzip your dockers. And if it were that easy, I wouldn't be standing in the bar at 13 o'clock wondering what in the hell I'm doing and how I got here and why I don't have any other place to go. So fuck it. And before I'm halfway out the door, some guy's asking, "Hey, isn't that a queer bar?" And before I can even turn and look, somebody's swinging something at my head, and the old reflexes kick in, and I duck sideways, and he misses. But then the other guy's got a bike chain, stupid college kid, which I don't mean to grab, but I get it anyway, because the skittles off the cast on my arm before he could swing. Indecision, maybe. Probably his first queer bash in blood, simple coward. Then I'm holding the chain one good yank, and he's holding a big handful of me, and his eyes go white just in time as I swing him around and shove him into his boyfriend with the baseball bat, and that's when I see the third one. Well, someone ought to teach these little pricks how to beat up a fag, because they're no good at this at all. The third one crumples up too easily. A backhand across the windpipe, big ugly rings with scratchy things, and he's down. And then I'm back with Chainless and Bat, shoving Chainless into Bat and both up against the wall so Bat can't move. And Chainless is already screaming for mommy. God forbid somebody should scar his pretty face like mine. And something happens. And that's when I get the idea that all he really needs is to be kissed. And so I pull him close and cover his scream with the bearded oyster and give him enough tongue to choke a deep throat. And I guess right, because just as he's starting to kiss me back, surprising me more than him, I think. And if this were a different time and a different place, I bet I could hang his legs over my shoulders or mine over his. I'm not choosy, except the bad boy is screaming, and who can concentrate with all that noise? By the time Danny Bartender finally makes it out the door with his own baseball bat, I got two on the ground and one up against the wall with my hand on his throat, the pretty one, and I really do think I could negotiate a relationship out of this, except that even as a cute meat, this is a little too acute. So I let go of the cute meat, and he staggers forward almost into my arms, jerks back, looks around, sees the queers piling out the queer bar, and maybe he thinks about running, but before he can send a message to his sketches, it's too late. He's caught. But Danny Bartender wants to call the police, but I tell him not to bother, because the one guy on the floor is having too much trouble breathing. I didn't think I hit him that hard, but he's got a nasty bubbling cut across his neck, which reminds me of things I saw in the service that I really don't want to think about at all. And the other guy who forgot about holding his bat when holding his stomach and his balls become a lot more important is having his own problems exsanguinating through his nose. So I go and pop open the back doors of my van and toss him in. I sold the Hawk 6 months ago and bought the van because he's on my bad leg. And besides, you can sleep in a van if you have to. When somebody asks, where are you taking him? And even though I want to take him out in the desert and bury him without bothering to kill him first, I say the emergency room because I already got enough death on my conscience. A pretty boy rides in front with me, the other two moaning in the back, and nobody else wants to come because one queer wants to talk with cops anyway. I'm not worried. Nobody fucks with me twice, not when I got their wallets in my pocket. Pull up at the ER, and I drag them both out the back of the van and through the sliding doors, shouting, white male, age 20, injured to his trachea, might need to intubate. White male, age 20, needs an x-ray, full crack rib, broken nose, and someone call the police. And I only have to holler twice before a doctor and two nurses come running. Tell the police I'm Emmett Grogan. Too young to know the real Emmett Grogan. And besides, I got the idea that proves I'm Emmett Grogan. I made it myself. Tell the police these two injured boys were just coming out of a gay bar 13 o'clock in the night when they was attacked by queer bashers. Lucky for them, I was driving by a little brother back to campus. I point the pretty boy. And we were just passing by. Ex-Marine, Vietnam vet, ex-corpsman, got the tattoo in San Diego. Yes, sir, no, sir, I didn't see the attackers. Clearly, officer, there was four of them. They looked like accountants or maybe lawyers, probably Republicans. You know, they like to do that sort of thing. The cops give me a narrow-eyed look, and I give them the deadpan. And then the fat one says, well, if the victims were coming out of a queer bar, they probably got what they deserved. I don't see any need to pursue this further. And the skinny one adds, yeah, but maybe we should notify their parents. They look like college students. And I say, nah, give them a break. They're just kids. Maybe this will teach them to stay away from queer bars. And the fat cop says, nah, once they've been into a queer bar, you can't keep them out. One taste of cock, and they're queer for life. So I just look at them deadpan and ask, is sucking cock that good? Like he knows, and he blinks for a moment, realizing he can't answer that question without looking either queer or stupid. Well, back in the van, pretty boy still hasn't said a word. He's scared I'm going to finish that kiss, or maybe he's hoping. But either way, he's sweating, so I hand him all three wallets after taking out the cash, my own brand of justice, payment for lesson learned, nearly 400 total. I drive him to the dorm, and as we pull up, he says, thank you for not reporting me to the cops. And at least he doesn't try to blame the other guys. It's all their fault. It wasn't his idea. He was just tagging along, which is obvious anyway. Pretty boy is book smart, but not much else. But at least he knows enough not to say anything that stupid. So I think about all the bullshit I could say back to him and decide not to say any of it. Instead, I look him straight in the eye and say, difference between us, someone calls me faggot, they're talking about what makes me happy. Someone calls you faggot, they're talking about what makes you unhappy. You figured out all that money mommy and daddy are spending to send you away to university. You ought to be smart enough to figure out what you like. And then he does surprise me. He starts to open the door to get out, and then he turns back and says, can we talk sometime? And there it is, 1:30, dry and windy after midnight, and he's got big eyes and chewable lips, and surprise, surprise, my dick can still get hard. So I say, yes, and how about tomorrow night? And he says, pick me up right here. And I'm already thinking, we'll go somewhere out on the other side of the desert where the truth is a lot easier. I know he'll never show up, not after 12 hours of sunlight thinking, but what the fuck, nobody's waiting for me in the next town either, so why not? sleep away most of the day, crawl out of my coffin just in time to enjoy the sunset, shower and burger at the truck stop, think about beer, but leave it at thinking, not drinking. Cruise over to the landing zone, and pretty boy's leaning against the wall. He flicks his cigarette sideways like he thinks that butch it isn't. And he strolls over and climbs in the passenger seat, and I roll without talking, and he doesn't say anything either. And I'm wondering what the fuck he thinks is going to happen tonight, because I sure as shit don't have a clue, but this is something better than nothing. We drive for a while, and pretty boy finally says something. I was afraid you wasn't going to come, I tell him. I didn't think he'd be there either, so we even... He asks where we're heading, and I shrug and nod ahead. Away from the light, because I don't like the light. If it's too bright, I can see the scars on my face from the inside. He tells me to stop calling him Pretty Boy. His name is Michael. I tell him he hadn't earned a name yet. He's still meat fresh off the plane, and we got a body bag already waiting with his name on it. Deal with it. Finally, I ask him what the fuck he wants from me. He says he wants to know what I know, and I tell him I don't know shit. And finally we turn off the highway onto a side road, and after a while off the side road onto a couple of forgotten ruts. And we go 2 or 3 miles up and down, bouncing to a place where something used to be, but now there's only hard-packed dirt, and I pull off and turn the engine off, and we sit and listen to it cooling in the night. We get out, I go around to the back, pull out a blanket, a couple bottles of water. We sit in the dark, side by side, watching for shooting stars, and except for pointing them out to each other, we don't talk. Waiting for him to stop, but he doesn't. So after a while, I reach over and grab his hand, not because I particularly want to hold his hand. I don't even fucking know him, but it's a start. Well, he's not good for small talk, neither am I. He asked me how I know how to fight. I tell him the truth, fighting is easier than having the shit kicked out of you. And then he asked me about my leg, so I tell him. Somewhere in the fucking Delta, the hot wind putrid old country stinking like a Saigon whorehouse, disintegrating with the smell of shit and incense and rotten vegetation, all mixed with the spices they use to hide the fact the meat is rotten before they even get it into the pan, even if they knew what it was. Dog, a cat, a rat, who the fuck cares? When you get hungry enough, you stop asking questions. They call it a road, but it's just a stinking, lousy dirt scar, a slash of mud car between 2 fields, the crap grass rippling in the wind, the distant edges bordered by trees, a perfect fucking place to die, a fucking bullseye for ambush. The lieutenant holds up a hand, and we all stop, and then he holds his arms straight out and waves us down, and we scatter into the grass and disappear. They say that Charlie is terrified of us because we're monsters, bigger and healthier, better fed, better guns, better ammo, better supplies, and better targets, too. These little human cockroaches scuttle down into the ground and disappear, trap doors in the floor of the world. Everybody knows they're all underground. The Delta's tunneled from here to forever underground cities. You go walk from here all the way to Uncle Ho without ever seeing daylight. And maybe they're right. Maybe the little fuckers are scared shitless, but I don't think so. Claymore, we call him that because he's good at taking minds apart. He grins and whispers across to me, "It's a good day to die." I tell him, "Shut the fuck up. It's never a good day to die." But he saw that in a movie and he thinks it's cool. It isn't cool. It's fucking stupid. And what are we waiting for anyway? Lieutenant is yabbering into the field phone. The sweat is rolling down the inside of my shirt. The sun's 130 degrees and we all carry 50 pounds of field gear. Whose good idea was this anyway? The field isn't a field, it's a fucking swamp. We're up to here in mud so deep, every step the mud is fighting to pull my boots off, and I can't stand too long in one place, I start to sink deeper. Oh man, I'm gonna stand for an hour in the shower tonight, and I don't fucking care what color the water is. Lieutenant, he stands up and waves us back to the road, whatever, he does this 5-6 times an hour. Squelching up out of the mud before I could yank my boot free, the whole fucking world blows up in my face, all the different colors of orange and white and red and black all at once, and everybody's screaming because the shit is going off all around us. They're dropping fucking mortar shells on us, and they got our range because the crap is hitting left and right and up and down. Claymore flies apart in pieces. A fucking good day to die my fucking ass, and I'm too busy pulling my goddamn leg out of mud to be scared. We're all firing wildly at the distant trees like we're really going to hit something, and we're fucking dead out here. Rocks and shit and mud comes pattering down all around, a pummeling of earth. It goes on forever while the ground shakes and your ears bleed and the world turns sideways and knocks you ass over everywhere. And no, my leg isn't supposed to bend that way, but I can't feel it anyway, and I can't find my fucking gun. And while my hand is flailing around, everything turns orange. The sky, the muck wall of heat knocks me splat into the shit, rolls me sideways, and then I hear the first roar of the flames, a roiling carpet, napalm forest blossoming scars across the whole west side of the world, and for a moment there's a kind of peace. The explosion stops, shocked and fucking horror, roasted alive, who fucking cares? I fade out and over. Something is whopping up and I feel nothing. While I'm dead, everything is fine, because I can't feel anything. I don't care. I could go on like this forever. White light and voices.
Something happened.
But then it's gone, leaving only a memory of a memory, a sense that there was something important. Maybe it was the drugs, but no, I know drugs, and this wasn't drugs. This was something else, but it's gone. It's like hearing the echo, but not knowing what. Clang, the feeling stays with me all the way across the Pacific and down into the crevices of San Francisco. It never fades, a sense of muffled awareness. The doctors tell me it's resonance, it'll go away, but they're wrong, it doesn't. Never completely, it just drifts behind inside forever. It doesn't bother me, it just turns into something to live with, like the plastic leg. So I spent a few years riding a hog up and down the left coast, cruising up through Big Sur, across the Big Red Bridge, up through Marin, into the cold, wet, wild north, where the trees make green canyons, up into Oregon, where the green is too thick, and I start thinking about Charlie creeping through the green, and if Charlie had green like this, we'd still be there. It's nothing like the Delta. First of all, the smell is sweet and green and wet, but I can't shake the feeling that something is creeping up after me. So I keep riding on up as far as Puget, where the only difference between the fog and the rain is that the fog is thicker and wetter. And from there up to the border, where the Canadian Customs Guard is so exquisitely polite, I know he hates to let me in, but he can't find a reason not to. I'm legal, I just look ugly. So on into Canada, all the way up to Alaska, and I lose myself a few years with the bears and the salmon and the air so crisp it cuts like ice through the tent, through the sleeping bag. And man, I'm getting too old for this shit, but I gotta know what it was. And for some reason I made up my mind that the Inuit know, some shaman or medicine man, whatever, cause maybe underneath there's some magic here. Yeah, maybe there is, but I never find it. So I come sliding back south, dropping down for Idaho, following the Snake River all the way down, passing through forgotten, dusty places with names too small for the map, endless dry highways into Nevada with its desolate, empty stretches of baking summer, east to Utah, where the canyons still echo with fossilized time, south to New Mexico with its hidden villages carved into orange sunset cliffs, went west to Arizona and up the poisonous side of Superstitious Mountain. Maybe there's a wise old grandfather, you know, the Hopi know life out of balance. And eventually south through Mexico, where I spend a week or year, whatever, living the way of the wacky, you know, eating mushrooms and peyote and rattlesnakes, fucking everything I can push down on its back or its stomach. If it's a hole and I'm horny, I don't care anymore. It doesn't matter. There's that instant of orgasm, that quick throbbing spurt of time where I stop existing long enough that the nagging sense of something unsaid and left undone is pushed so far out of my consciousness it almost doesn't exist for that moment. And the lassitude afterward on my back and staring dispassionately at the glowering sky, waiting for wisdom and insight, that connection of time and place and understanding. But all I accomplish is a 1,000 light year stare with nothing on the other side. And one day I put the hog back together, get the engine running, tune it and tweak it, test it over and over till it sounds like magic growling again. Till one day is right and the moment is right and I get on and start riding. Just a test ride, I say, but I keep riding north and never look back. I run out of gas at a queer hippie commune south of Tucson and live in a teepee while I flush out all the crap from my system. I lose 20 pounds of Mexican bad shit and end up with abs again, stomping up and down the rows of corn and bean and tomatoes, digging latrines, carrying water, hoeing and weeding, learning to serve others again. And for the first time in longer than I can remember, actually earning the right to feel good about myself at the end of the day. But it's all queer boys here, and I'm not ready to give up girl pussy forever. It's fixed in my mind now that there's boy pussy and girl pussy, and each is fine in its own way. And by now I've even learned there's other things to do, and maybe that's part of the answer. If not the answer, it's still part of it, because what these queer boys have learned is that it's not about fucking. It's about people. A strange place to learn this. And then an angry flash. I don't know how it happens. I'm back on the left again. Arizona, a red and gold memory in the rearview mirror. How'd that happen? The moving finger writes. And once it writes, you're fingered. I come bouncing down into the Castro where I hook up with Bloody Mary, a bull dyke who rides a hog, and sometimes she rides me, and sometimes she rides the hog, and once she rides us both at the same time. And I ask, how can she be a dyke if she's riding the rod? And she just laughs and says, it isn't about pussy, it's about people. So I'm not the only one who's figured that out. We coast up to Guerneville where nobody cares, where we're out of earshot of the creepazoids who think we're traitors to the fag flag because we're bumping each other ugly. Except one night I break my leg in Sausalito, laying down a bike to avoid a drunken, spoiled teenage bitch. And if I could have gotten up afterward, I'd have punched her a new one. But I can't get up because the bike is on top of me. She jumps out and starts wailing about the dent I just put in the side of a new car that Daddy just bought her only 2 days ago for his 17th birthday, while I'm still lying under a bleeding hog. And it happens again. Until Mary the Dyke slaps her, takes away her new expensive toy, this thing called a cell phone, and punches 911 and calls an ambulance, and I'm off to the ER tonight and the VA tomorrow. Fortunately, it's the plastic leg that's broken, and 6 weeks later, the VA finally puts me on a new one, a better one, and I'm ready to get back in the saddle, except I don't want to. Something's happened. I can't explain it, but something's happened. And even though I feel like a cowboy who has to shoot his horse, I sell the hog what's left of it. No, it isn't fear. I can get back on the bike in half a minute. I trust myself on the road. I don't trust anyone else. I trust my ability to keep out of their way. But if a 17-year-old bitch can put me down in the gutter, maybe it's the universe sending me a message. The dyke tells me I'm a pussy, so I know she don't understand it. Fuck it, I'm not even sure I understand it myself. All I know is it's time to let go. The bike isn't me anymore, and neither is the dyke. And then time flashes, and I'm living out the back of a VW bus. I don't even remember where I got it, but the feeling is there. I can drive out to the middle of the Mojave, get off the highway, get off the side road, find a dirt slash into the middle of nowhere, someplace even the lights in the distance are too far away to look like anything more than stars glimmering through the bottom of the world, and I lay down on my back and look up at the diamond sky, and it's like riding the hog again, only this time riding it through time and space. I'm standing at the front of Starship Earth, and I'm sailing forward like I'm king of the universe, and I can hear the feeling loud and clear, like picking up channel KOMA from five states away. And I know it's not the tequila, it's not the grass, and it's not a fucking acid flashback either. It's something else, and I can feel the throbbing pulse of the ground beneath my body, and I know the ground doesn't throb and pulse, so what the flaming fuck am I feeling? It's just my own heart beef. Slabs of muscle too stubborn to stop slamming the blood through my veins, but what the fuck is life all about anyway? But the feeling it won't go away. It's like music sometimes, a distant chorus, very faint and far away under the edge of the horizon, like those things, whatever they are, that always woke me when I was little, going, whoo, whoo, in the night, and I tell Pretty Boy, that's what I know, that I'm just another hood ornament on the battering ram. Wherever it goes, I get there first, hardest. I'm the part takes the impact. But every time, just before the collision, I get this flash, like there's something under the bottom of the world calling to me. I don't know what the fuck it is, but I can't get away from it. Can't get it to shut up, can't forget it, and can't fucking die until I find out what it is. So now it's his turn to explain it. He tells me there's nothing to explain. He isn't anybody at all. He just doesn't, and it doesn't matter that there's no predicate to that subject. I get it, because I've been there. I'm still there. I live there. We all do, only some of us know it. He says it started in bed with a girl. She was warm and round and luscious, like something out of a painting by Rubens or maybe Titian, and he just wanted to float on top of her like she was a giant, delicious waterbed. He wanted to suckle at her breasts and bury his face in a juicy cunt, and it surprised him when I said, yeah, I know, so whatever else she wasn't either, and she wouldn't. They'd lie together spooned, his arm curled around his side, but once when his fingers started tentatively brushing at her thigh, she mumbles, not now, and another time when he brushes at her lips, the lower ones probing for her clit, she pushes his hand away roughly as if he's an intruder, and still another time when he moves his fingers up to circle her great silver dollar-sized nipples, she rolls away. Is that all you ever think about? So he turns on his side and tries to sleep while his great moby of desirability rests naked behind him, his cock still stiff, his balls aching, and next morning as he's pulling his tighty-whities up and over the tent pole, she sits up in bed and complains that he's unromantic, that he doesn't want to do it with her, and it's because she's fat, isn't it? And to his credit, he doesn't say anything. He just finishes pulling up his pants, he buttons his shirt, slips into his sneakers, and closes the door behind him, all without a word or even a look, because inside he's feeling so... There isn't really a word for that feeling, but that's what he's feeling. So he leaves, and 3 nights later, he's outside a queer bar with 2 guys he barely knows. It doesn't make sense, but nothing in life makes sense. Why would anyone want to fuck a guy when there are all these beautiful fat women around, except they don't want to fuck? What's a guy going to do? Get desperate, and he's almost ready to cry, except he's still too full of that other feeling. So there we are. I have too much life, and he doesn't have any. So I hold his hand, and after a while he leans up against me, and we sit there listening. He listens for what I can hear, and I listen for silence. "Are you going to fuck me?" he asks, and I don't answer for a while, because I don't know the answer. I don't know if I want to fuck him. He's pretty enough, and after that kiss, I didn't figure it would be that hard to get his ankles behind his neck or mine. It doesn't matter, but I don't know if it's worth the effort. Fucking for the sake of fucking sounds fine when you're 15, but not when the digits are reversed. So I'm sitting there wondering why he asked. Is it something he wants, or is it something he's afraid I'm going to do to him, whether he wants it or not? And just the fact he asked the question scares the shit out of me, not the scared, shitless feeling like when live fire is making a 3-foot ceiling over your head, but the other scared feeling of just not knowing who you are or what you're supposed to do. Feeling I thought I left behind in Alaska or Mexico or maybe certainly in Arizona or probably somewhere since then, but finally I just say... "Is that what you want?" And he doesn't answer, because I figure he's probably sorting it out the same way. And then the moment passes, and I know we're not going to fuck, not then, and probably not ever, but I've been wrong about that before, so we both just relax. Now the question's been asked, not answered, but resolved anyway for the moment, and I'm sitting there thinking a whole fucking epic, and he says, "Thank you." And I ask, "For what?" And he says, "For listening." And yeah, I get it. And I say so, and he asks, "Does this feeling ever go away?" And even though I'm not sure what feeling he's talking about, I still know the answer. I shake my head. I say, "No, it never does. You just learn to live with it." He breaks away. He sits opposite so he can look at me. The moon is up now, 4:30, so there's enough light I can see his eyes are bright. And yeah, he's getting prettier by the moment, and I'm almost rethinking the answer to his question, but I'm not, because it still isn't happening. And in the moonlight... I know why. There's this guy I knew once. His name was Jerry. We went to the same high school. We never talked to each other. We just saw each other in the hallway sometimes. Sometimes at the Big Boy, where he was bussing tables, working his way through community college. But we weren't in any of the same classes there either. We just saw each other around, and then I forgot about him the way you forget most of the people you bump up against as you stumble along, until one night a few years later, it's the collapsing end of 1969, and I'm in a boy bar on Santa Monica Boulevard, and I see him sitting alone in the corner in the back patio, and he looks like Wile E. Coyote right after the rocket exploded in his face. So I go over and say hi, and he says hi back, and I ask him what's wrong. He can't even get it out. He just looks at me with a look I only seen one other time, a year later in the Delta, when Perry, the black kid with the big round eyes, caught one and just looks at me, his hands across his belly, all his dark red blood pulsing out between his fingers, trying to push his guts back in. And he looks at me, our eyes meet for just a second, and the expression on his face says it all. "Please tell me I'm going to be all right. Tell me I'm not going to die." And he knows I won't lie to him, and I lie and say, "Hey, man, just hold on. Just hold on." And the medic stings him with morphine, and his eyes stay fixed on mine the whole time, and then the blood stops pulsing. And he's dead, but his eyes are still wide, and that's the look I saw on Jerry's face, like he was asking me to tell him that he wasn't dead yet. But that hadn't happened yet. This was the first time I ever saw this look, and it stopped me cold, because I didn't know a human face could look like that. And it froze me. The terror, the desperate need. I thought I should do something, except I wasn't in that bar to be Mary Poppins. I was looking for some boy pussy, and I was this close to saying, "Fuck it, tell it to the chaplain. Tell it to someone who cares, someone who's paid to care." But then he says, "Tell me why I shouldn't kill myself." And I didn't have the sense to back away quickly, so I stand over him, instinctively shielding him from the light and the noise and the stink of cigarettes and beer and Old Spice, and I listen, and what he tells me... Well, it almost saves my life. See, he wasn't making it. It was the end of the fucking 60s, for God's sake. Everything was falling apart in slow motion, and all anybody could do was get stoned and fuck their brains out, so that's what we did all night long, every night. There wasn't any daytime anymore, just that long, long night of parties. Only Jerry was alone, one of those guys who never quite finds the rhythm of anything. He didn't know how to be whatever it was he was supposed to be. Nobody did, and everybody's walking around saying stupid shit like, "Hey man, where's it happening?" And you have no fucking idea how dumb that sounds. It's like admitting you're so lost you can't even see the party even when it's happening around you. It was happening everywhere, and it wasn't happening anywhere, because whatever was happening, it was only happening when you made it happen. But most of us never learned that lesson, or died trying. So even though Jerry didn't understand it, that was the thing that made him just like everybody else, because nobody understood it yet. But Jerry was one of the smart ones. So smart he was stupid. He thought the world was gettable. And because he thought that, he thought that there were people who actually did get it. In fact, Jerry thought almost everybody did. Probably already had, except they'd all privately agreed not to let him in on it. None of it made sense, and nobody was letting him in on the jokes. After a while, he gives up. Just gives up completely and resigns. Stops waiting for Santa Claus and starts waiting for rigor mortis. He's ready to be just another one of those used-up boys propped up against the bar like scenery. One's been entered too many times and finally abandoned all hope. The ones who settle for fucking as a substitute for loving. Nowhere near a fair trade, but if you fuck long enough and hard enough, sometimes you don't notice. Trust me on this. Except fucking God's a practical joker, because just when Jerry decides there ain't no such thing as either God or love, that's the afternoon. God drops a beautiful red-headed boy on him, and the two of them do something right, and instead of just falling lustfully into bed, mindlessly fucking their brains out on each other's flesh until half past C around, instead it's too hot to fuck, so they sit and talk for 5 hours on this sweaty July afternoon, and instead of thinking only about their dicks, they actually work a little higher up the other end of the spinal cord, and not until the day finally cools off do they end up in bed. But that's only because it's a more comfortable place to just strip down to your jockeys and relax, surrender to the moment, because it doesn't matter anymore. You don't have to pretend now, just be who you are. And they still don't fuck. They share a big glass of ice water and keep talking. It doesn't matter what they're talking about. They're just having this amazing adventure, talking and discovering. And even after they get naked, and you know how you get naked in front of other guys, there's this thing, you know, the thing where you really don't want them looking at you, because you know they're sizing you up, judging how good you look or how big you are, and you know you're never going to look as good as the guys in the magazines, and you end up feeling that you don't want to be naked in front of anyone because you don't want them thinking you're not good enough. Except that doesn't happen here, see? They end up sitting together naked, unashamed, each one astonished at how beautiful the other one is. And they still don't fuck. They hug and kiss and touch and wonder. And they laugh a lot at some shared joke of intimacy. And finally take a shower together and laugh a whole lot more. And then they hump and bump a little, even a lot, but they keep interrupting themselves to talk and to share. And before either one of them has come anywhere near that moment where it's time to get a towel and wipe off and make a hasty, graceless exit, they realize that something is happening. It's silly, so fucking silly, because there's no such thing as love at first sight. That's just a fairy tale. But there they are anyway, falling ass over tea kettle, tumbling over the cliff of joyous delirium, so full of happy giggle and exuberance it doesn't make sense, until Jerry has impossible tears running down his cheeks, and he wants to run out in the middle of the street and yell to the whole world, "Don't you dumb fucks get it? Love, real love, really is possible, and if Hitler ever had sex, this good World War II would never happen." That's what it feels like. Fucking so good you feel sorry for Hitler, and he and the red-headed boy roll together laughing. But look, it isn't about the sex at all. It was never about the sex. Everybody thinks it's about the cocks and the cunts and the mouths and the assholes, all that juicy pistoning, the hot, wet pumping in and out, but it isn't. It's about the thing that happens during sex, if it's right, if everything is right between the two people, whoever, whatever, if there's a real connection. Then the sex is just a way to get even more connected. Of course, it's the connection you want, not the sex. Because the truth is, when you're fucking, it's not about you, it's about the person you're with. Because if it isn't, then you're the biggest dumb fuck of all, just licking the menu instead of eating the meal. And that's the magic that Jerry and his beautiful red-headed boy fell into. Yeah, I know. Doesn't make sense to sit and talk with someone from 4 o'clock in the afternoon until 9 in the fucking a.m. the next morning when you have to get up and get back to work and on the basis of that short time know that this is the person you want to spend the rest of your life with, that all you want from existence is to keep on exploring the landscape of this beautiful, incredible godling, discovering yourself in his smile and his laughter and his cockness. But it happened to them, both of them. They connected anyway. And in the days after that first incredible revelation of each other, it just gets better. They start learning how to do all the other things that people do when they fit their lives together. They talk to each other on the phone every day for 3 weeks, grabbing every moment they can between their respective jobs and obligations. It should have been perfect, because each of them was exactly what the other one wanted and needed. They fit, you know, they just fit. And every moment was, well, you know, just perfect. And then it all comes apart, because Jerry makes a stupid mistake, the biggest stupid mistake anyone can make. He gets scared. He stops trusting his instincts, because, see, the red-headed boy wants to get serious. I mean, serious with a capital. Let's move in together. And Jerry panics, because he thinks it's getting too intense. He can't deal with it. He doesn't know how. I mean, how do you explain it to Mom, right? Because nobody gives lessons to queer boys how to have a real relationship and make it work in a world that mindlessly believes that this thing that brings you so much joy is so despicable that God hates you for it. And the whole thing scares him, so instead of being home, he leaves a note on the door and goes out cruising instead. Not because he wants to cruise, but because he doesn't know what else to do. But he's just so fucking confused. So the red-headed boy takes the note off the door and goes out looking for something else to do, and he picks up a hitchhiker. No, not quite. That's not where this story is going. Let me finish. And the hitchhiker is caretaker at some estate up in Benedict Canyon. So the red-headed boy drives him up there, and they talk for a while. But they don't really connect, so after a while, the red-headed boy picks up the phone and calls Jerry. And Jerry's back home by now. See, here's what happened. Jerry cruises and realizes that cruising is empty, because now that he knows that there's something else, cruising is meaningless. And now that he knows what the something else is, he knows what a jerk he's been for leaving that note, for not being home, and all he really wants to do tonight is curl up with his beautiful red-headed lover and not have to talk. Just be in his arms and never be apart again. He's ready to jump off the diving board and say, "Yes, I will." Only on the way down the hill, the red-headed boy runs into some drug-crazed hippies, and they shoot him in the face, and then they go into the house and murder 4 other people. 5, if you count the unborn baby. And Jerry stays up all night wondering where his lover is, and he doesn't find out what happened till he opens a newspaper Sunday morning. Still with me? And he goes crazy, and I don't mean crazy like banging into the walls, raging with grief. I mean crazy like you don't know. Nobody knows, because they don't know how to show it in the movies yet. I mean crazy like staring into space crazy, zombie crazy, desperate crazy. And who the fuck can he talk to about it? Because who in the world would understand? Certainly no straight man. Maybe another faggot, except all he knows about boy bar faggots is that he don't trust any of them either. He knows who they are because he's one of them too. And it's 2-3 months later, and the murderers still haven't been caught. And he tells me all of this in the back patio of a sleazy boy bar in West Hollywood because he has no other place to go. And of all the places to go, this is the worst, because it just puts him back where he was before, but he can't be what he was before, because this time now, he knows what he doesn't have. And that's when the tears start running down his cheeks. All he had was 3 weeks. Hardly enough time to make any memories at all. Just a couple of fucks and a drive around the city. And all he can think of is he's never going to see his lover again. The most precious person in his life. Never again. And all the memories they're never going to have. All the pillow conversations. And why the hell should he keep on living if the best part of his life is over? But see, here's how I know that God is a malignant thug, a practical joker, an asshole. If he wouldn't listen to his own son's prayers on the cross, why the fuck do you think he's going to listen to anyone else's? See, here's the joke. Jerry looks at me like I'm supposed to say the one thing, whatever it is, that makes a difference. Except, I don't know what the fuck it is. How the hell should I know how to save his life? Because I can't even save my own. Because I got my goddamn draft notice in my back pocket, and I have to report the day after Thanksgiving. And in 3-4 months, just in time for the rains, I'll be slogging through the goddamn Delta with all the other dead men walking. And I'm thinking, what the fuck? Maybe I should run for Canada instead, I can be there in a straight two-day run. Or maybe I should just tell them I like sucking cock and fucking ass. At least that's honest. Except I'm not ready to be that honest yet. Nobody is. Except I also heard they don't even care anymore, the draft boards. They just have to generate so many bodies a week. Fill up the green uniforms. Fill up the body bags. And this week it's me, and next week it's you. It's all the same. And Jerry looks up at me and says, "So okay, now you tell me. Why shouldn't I kill myself?" I don't know. Why shouldn't he? He's made a pretty damn good case. Except forever is a long time. And I'm thinking if I were a sky pilot, I'd know the right thing to say. Except I'm not, and I don't. And besides, if I said the crap they say, we both know it's crap. So I say what's in my head. And I say, "I am so fucking jealous of you, I can't believe it." And his eyes go wide, and I just keep talking anyway, because, man, you found it, even if it was only for 3 weeks. You had it, man. I never did, and you'll know something most the rest of us can only wish for. And he looks at me, not getting it, and I don't know where the words are coming from. I just blurted out, "Real love, man. You had it. Somebody really loved you. The rest of us were standing around and pretending that we're not standing around and pretending, but you, man, you're lucky. Everybody else in here doesn't beat you to death out of sheer fucking jealousy, because what you had the real, not the pretend. You had it." And maybe that was what he needed to hear. And maybe what he said was what I needed to hear, that it really was possible, because up until then, I didn't know it. Maybe nobody did. Jerry was the first person I ever knew who found love, the first one who could actually say it. And while he's crying for what he's lost, I'm wishing I were him. I want what he had, even if it's only for 3 weeks, or 3 days, or 3 hours. And as I'm telling all this, it's all pouring out of me in one dumb rush. I look across at the pretty boy and see only blankness in the eyes, and I realize he doesn't know what I'm talking about. Can't know, because he's never done it, never been there, never had that rush of endorphins, that wave of physical amazement that starts in the bottom of your dick and comes tidal waving up your spine like some kind of astonishing hot tsunami and floods up inside of you, inside your heart. Your whole chest chokes up your throat and floods your eyes with tears of wonder and joy. He's never known it. That's the fucking tragedy. He's never been there. And the question of sex with him, of fucking him, is finally answered for me, because if there's no connection, then all it is just fucking exercise, and I had enough exercise for 10 lifetimes. I don't want to wake up with an intimate stranger, someone who knows the taste of my sweat, but not the taste of me, just another zombie fuck. But there was that moment. I know it happened when he kissed back, and something flickered in that moment, and that's the moment I'm speaking to. Who was that? And how do I get back there? How does anyone? Did he kill himself? Pretty boy asks. It's the wrong question. I shake my head. To tell the truth, I don't know. I never saw him again. Maybe he did. Maybe he didn't. Maybe he just stumbled out into the night just like everybody else. You crawl into your coffin and don't come back out until it's time to feed again. I stand, stretch, listen to the bones tap dancing against each other. Stretch again, denying entropy one more time. Start picking up blankets and water bottles. "Is that it?" he asks. And I turn and look at him. "What did you want?" And he doesn't answer, doesn't have an answer. Maybe that's the greater tragedy. Worse than knowing what you want and never having it is never knowing, never being able to speak it at all. Headed back in silence, bumping over the hard-packed dirt, finally up and onto the asphalt again. Sliding through the dark, the wind roaring like a jet engine, and still he doesn't talk for some reason. He doesn't look so pretty anymore, and I'm wondering why I bothered, why I wasted my time, and why I didn't fuck him anyway, except even an old boar like me has some pride. Something happened. I never talk about the blinks. Nobody understands. I tried a couple times, but I got that look, you know, the one that says, "I'm going to pretend I understand you, but only for as long as it takes me to gnaw off my leg and escape. And no, we can't ever be drinking buddies again, because you're crazier than me. There's something scary wrong in your head." So I learned the hard way. I just don't talk about the blinks. Not to anyone. And when they happen, they happen. Nobody around me notices. So maybe I am crazy. It's somebody cutting into the movie. Just a dazzling flash of bright, way too fast to see. You only realize it afterward. Except afterward, there's the burn-in still hanging in the air, the after-images of whatever seared into my existential retinas. Never found anybody who knew about it, even with careful asking. None of the gurus, nor the medicine men, the shamans, not the dopers and dealers neither. Asked a few doctors and corpsmen if they ever heard anything like it, but they just looked at me funny, so I dropped the subject. Only once, the crazy dyke, late one night on a road, somewhere between nowhere and nothing, we finally pull over and fall out onto our blankets, eventually end up on our backs, first her and then me and then both of us, staring up at the stars. Something happens, and I ask her, did you feel that? And she asks, feel what? And I try to explain, and she says, well, you got pinged. And I said, pinged? What's that? And she says, it's when somebody is checking you out, seeing if you're there. Like submarines in the dark, I ask. She says, no, it's like computers on a network. I ping you and you pong back. As if you ain't ponging, but somebody's definitely pinging. And that's as far as that conversation goes, but it sticks. Enough so that whenever something happens, I'm listening to hear who it is or what. Aliens or angels or I don't know, the mystery horror Saigon. How'd you get the clap, soldier? I don't know, sir. I'm listening like the antenna at Arecibo. Except I'm always listening after, never during, never before. It's like lightning. You only know you've been struck by it when you pick yourself up off the ground afterward, like Jerry and his redhead. And I figure that maybe I'm the wrong kind of receiver. Or maybe I'm not getting the whole signal, or maybe I'm in the fringe area. I don't know, again. And the only part of any of it that I can be sure of is that it never happens when I'm alone. It only happens when I'm with someone, and only when the moment is intense, very intense, too intense, almost overload. That's when it happens, when the meter is pinned. Other people, they talk about those moments when everything happens at once, when the car starts to skid, when it goes skidding, swerving, screeching sideways. That's the moment when time stops for them. For me, that's the moment when time disappears and I come out the other side still ringing all over, reconnecting to myself. I know I'm missing something here. I used to think that if I could find someone else, anyone who experienced the same thing, then maybe we could, I don't know, connect. And if it happened to us together at the same time, maybe we could get a clearer signal. Except when I talk about the blinks, the pings, I get the stare, the what-are-you-talking-about look. So that's not an option. Except, yeah, at the back of my mind, I'm still always thinking, maybe this one, maybe this time. Maybe finally I'll find out who's calling, who's pinging. And sometimes I'll go days, weeks, months without a ping, and I'll miss it for a while. Then I'll get used to the silence, and then I'll even forget about the pings for a while until it starts again. And once lying awake in some strange bed in the middle of some strange night, I had this thought that maybe I'm only one piece of the circuit. Like a transistor, or a capacitor, or one of those other bits of electric magic. And maybe what I need isn't another piece like me, but some other piece totally unlike me. Maybe I'm just an antenna. Maybe I need a modulator, or a resonator, or maybe just a tuning knob. Or maybe there's a whole bunch of pieces missing, and maybe I'm not anything at all, just a chimpanzee hammering on a rock and striking an occasional spark. That's the other thought, that whatever it is, maybe it's something I can't know. Maybe none of us can, because we're not there yet. We can string some wires and make electricity run around in circles and sparkle from lights, but we still can't do that next thing, whatever it is. That next thing that comes after super sharp televisions and super fast computers. That thing we still haven't thought of, whatever will be. And by comparison with that, we're still just apes with bones and flints. And that's the thing I think about, listening to the stars, listening for others. Maybe we're listening with the wrong ears, and we can't really hear whoever is pinging. Maybe only a few of us can hear occasional bits and pieces of the pings, and the rest of us can't hear anything at all because we're just not there yet. We're still in bed with, I don't know, in the hot damp nights of Saigon. And oh, shit, Saigon. Perry, late one night, we play cut for low, and loser takes the point. Next day, on patrol. And it's Perry who catches it in the belly, not me. And it's Jerry all over again, only this time it's me with the guilt, with the story. It's my fault he died. I only lose a leg, but Perry spills his guts. And ever since then, I've been spilling mine. Only I never get to die. Perry was the lucky one. He got out quick. And I get it. I get it again. We're all dragging dead bodies around, offering each other a sniff of the corpse. The past is this heavy ruck that sits on our backs, growing heavier every year. We just keep adding more and more shit to the load, and eventually history is inescapable. This shitbird guru on my shoulder yabbers into my ear. The past defines not just the present, but the future as well. There's no escape, is there? This is it. And that's why I didn't fuck the pretty boy, because there's no place in my past for that future. Finally bring him back to where we started. The big empty parking lot below the dorm. Pulled to a stop. We look at each other, all the stuff still unsaid. Real stuff that nobody ever says. And just before the see you, something happens and the van starts shaking hard like something slamming against it from the side again and again. And then the lights of the world come on, dazzling, finger-stabbing, searching, finally pinning us in the van. And there's a great whooshing noise and screaming, too. All the voices in the world. Pretty boy grabs my hand and it happens. He's turned pretty again, pretty frightened. Everything slows down, stops. The eye of the time storm. Even while the banging continues around us, connection. All the flickers, all the blinks, everything. Time and space collapses into one moment, and this time I'm in the moment, caught. A dragonfly in amber gossamer, wings transparent in the heavenly backlight, and in the same instant, everything simultaneous. I get it! There's Jerry and Perry and Mary the Bull Dyke and even Pretty Boy and all the rest of us, everyone who connected, who flickered in and out, all of us woven by ganglia into the great neural web of sentience recognizing itself. That's who's been pinging, not aliens or angels or anything else. It's us, all of us together. That's the connection. Our own humanity is calling. It's the next step. It isn't a secret. It never was. Except all of us together, we never knew, or we keep forgetting, or we do it on purpose. But now this time, some of us actually see it happen.
The fireflower blossoms.
A hot rush, a tidal wave, tsunami of exuberance rising up through me. I can see to the end of the universe and back. All of us connecting, lighting up, answering the pings, awakening to ourselves, blinking alive, confused, excited, wondrous. Not everyone yet, but all of us who've heard the wake-up call. And in that moment, we're together, and we know. And it's now, and there's no going back. Oh, and then as the van topples and crashes sideways onto the street, the sirens come whooping in, the red and blue lights flickering, flashing, turning. The moment is broken, and I'm scrambling up over Pretty Boy to unlatch his door, push it open, start to climb out. And when the first bottle comes crashing against it, and a baseball bat wangs into the windshield, fracturing it but not shattering, so that isn't the way. I fumble sideways, crawl and kick out the back doors open with my good leg and come out with the aluminum bat in one hand, ready to bang the hell out of last night's bashers who've been waiting for me all night long with their fraternity brothers and a keg of beer. The whole gang of chimpanzees believing that I've kidnapped one of their own. They're going to rescue him from the bearded monster. Except the cops are already here, beanbag rifles at the ready, lights flashing, spotlights dazzling me. The chopper above pins me in a funnel light, so I drop the bat, raise my hands, I lie down slowly on the asphalt, because already I know how this will play out. I clean up real good. No piercings, no tats. Shaving a haircut, put on a clean suit. Yes, I have one, but leave the prosthesis at home. Fold up the pants leg and limp into court on a crutch. Tell the judge the bash is broken when they push my van over. A $7,000 peg, one battered old vet with no leg to stand on, opposite a bunch of frats with attitude. There's no question what will happen here. Six of them get expelled, a chapter gets its charter pulled, and the town has something to argue about until Christmas break. I'll be gone by then anyway. Autumn rolls away, and with it me. No more dry desert nights for this old bear. Maybe I'll drift south to the tip of Baja and lie naked in the unforgiving sun like a great bacon whale. Or maybe north into Canada again, Alaska, where I'll snuggle deep in a tiny cabin, hibernating like a grumpy old wolverine, listening to the snow piling up against the windows. Anywhere away from here, away from the madness and the noise, the squalor of human ignorance, all the vicious, scrabbling little souls that still don't get it, might never get it, will never get it, because all the clamor they make drowns out all other possibilities. They're screaming so loud about what they want, they can't hear that the answer is already yes. When your watch says 13 o'clock, what time is it? It's time to get a new watch. The pieces of this one are scattered all over the floor. It's time to build a new one.
Something is happening. It's still happening.
All the parts of me, us, we're scattered, yes, but we're pinged and connected, and we can sense, feel, hear each other. We're something new. Little two-year-old girl standing up in her crib, crying with a wet diaper, but that's not why she's crying. She's not yet ready for the burden of knowledge. A black grandmother suddenly awake in the night, wondering why she's thinking of her dead grandson all of a sudden. He died in Nam, but she can hear him somewhere. With all the time and space collapse, he's right here now. A skinny teenage boy, secretly trying on his sister's panties, abruptly confused, and wondering why he can suddenly see into the future, scared of what he's becoming and intrigued as well. The cop, holding the beanbag rifle, blinking, scanning the whole situation through a dozen different pair of eyes instead of just his own little piece. He sees through the perp's eyes, feels the fear and terror. A young woman, screaming, channeling a joyous, excruciating birth. The baby screams with a mother and child locked together in mutual awareness. The desperate man standing on the bridge, the choice in his eyes, suddenly alive beyond his own horizons, stepping back to reconsider. The student looking up from his book. There's a world out there, a vast, unknowable, incomprehensible world. The book, the words, the crawling insect marks upon the page, the barest shadow of meaning. There is no explanation. It's just what's happening. It's still happening now. And all of us, too, touched with wonder, frightened, intrigued, cautious, but stepping into the moment. It'll take a while. We'll get there. This thing, whatever it is we are, all of us still sorting it out. We're a long way from threshold and even farther from critical mass. We're alone, but not alone. Never alone. Never again. And Michael, I glance over at him, dazed and confused, but waking up into himself now. I wonder how many more we can wake up. That was 13 O'Clock by David Gerald from his collection The Involuntary Human, published by Nesva Press. For further information, visit www.gerald.com. That's spelled G-E-R-R-O-L-D. All right, that's a full lid, and this has been Spider on the Web number 63, a podcast brought to you, as always, under Creative Commons license, no derivatives, non-commercial. Your subscriptions and donations are welcomed at spiderrobinson.com. Repeated thanks to all of you who took the time and trouble to vote for me for the Sofonaut Awards. I really appreciate it. And now to take us out of here, this is my friend and former neighbor Corbin Keep, whom you can learn more about at the website wildcellist.com, with the last two tracks of his CD Call of the Wild Cello, both of which are called In Silent Awe.
Taking a moment to read between the lines. Stop, put the whole thing on pause. Step back, take a look. What is really going on? Taking a break from my morning toast. Peer inside the keyhole. Close one eye, focus in. What am I looking for? and I look in my daughter's eyes, so deep, so blue, and I feel my own disguise and know what's true. There's more to this world than I allow myself to see. Step outside under the stars, a sacred tapestry. That comet's light in silence, all in the mystery of this night, boundaries
I found my way, found my way.